Drink with me, brother, have a taste of this. He offered one of the cups to a Victorian. The captain took the cup Euron had not offered, sniffed at its contents suspiciously. Seen up close, it looked more blue than black. It was thick and oily, with a smell like rotted fish. He tried a small swallow, and spit it out at once.
Ugh, foul stuff! Do you mean to poison me?
I mean to open your eyes. Euron drank deep from his own cup, and smiled. Shade of the evening, the wine of the warlocks. I came upon a cask of it when I captured a certain Gallius out of Carth, along with some cloves and nutmeg, 40 bolts of green silk, and 4 warlocks, who told a curious tale. One presumed to threaten me, so I killed him and fed him to the other 3. They refused to eat of their friend's flesh at first, but when they grew hungry enough, they had a change of heart. Men are meat.
Balin was mad. Aaron is madder, and Euron is maddest of them all.
Victorian was turning to go when the crow's eye said, "A king must have a wife to give him heirs. Brother, I have need of you. Will you go to Slaver's Bay and bring my love to me?"
I had a love once, too.
Victorian's hand coiled into fists, and a drop of blood fell to patter on the floor.
I should beat you raw and red, and feed you to the crabs, the same as I did her.
"You have sons," he told his brother. "Base-born mongrels, born of whores and weepers.
They are of your body. So are the contents of my chamber-pot.
None is fit to sit the sea-stone chair, much less the iron throne. No, to make an heir that's worthy of him, I need a different woman. When the kraken weds the dragon, brother, let all the world beware."
"What dragon?" said Victorian, frowning.
"The last of her line. They say she is the fairest woman in the world. Her hair is silver gold, and her eyes are amethysts. But you need not take my word for it, brother. Go to Slaver's Bay. Behold her beauty, and bring her back to me."
"Why should I?" Victorian demanded.
"For love, for duty, because your king commands it."
Euron chuckled.
"And for the sea-stone chair. It is yours once I claim the iron throne. You shall follow me as I followed Balin, and your own true-born sons shall one day follow you."
"My own sons. But to have a true-born son, a man must first have a wife. Victorian had no luck with wives.
Euron's gifts are poisoned," he reminded himself.
"But still..."
"The choice is yours, brother. Live a thrall or die a king. Do you dare to fly? Unless you take the step, you'll never know."
Your unsmiling eye was bright with mockery.
"Or do I ask too much of you? It is a fearsome thing to sail beyond Valyria."
"I could sail the Iron Fleet to hell if need be." When Victorian opened his hand, his palm was red with blood. "I'll go to Slaver's Bay, aye. I'll find this dragon woman, and I'll bring her back.
But not for you. You stole my wife and despoiled her. So I'll have yours, the fairest woman in the world for me."
Jamie. The fields outside the walls of Derry were being tilled once more. The burned crops had been ploughed under, and Sir Adam's scouts reported seeing women in the furrows pulling weeds, whilst a team of oxen broke new ground on the edge of a nearby wood. A dozen bearded men with axes stood guard over them as they worked. By the time Jamie and his column reached the castle, all of them had fled within the walls. He found Derry closed to him, just as Harrenhal had been. "A chilly welcome for mine own blood," "Sound the horn," he commanded. Sir Kenneth of Case unslung the horn of Herrick and let it wind. As he waited for a response from the castle, Jamie eyed the banner floating brown and crimson above his cousin's barbican. Lancel had taken to quartering the Lion of Lannister with the Dairy ploughman, it would seem. He saw his uncle's hand in that, as in Lancel's choice of bride. House Derry had ruled these lands since the Andals cast down the first men. No doubt Sir Kevin realized that his son would have an easier time of it if the peasants saw him as a continuation of the old line, holding these lands by right of marriage rather than royal decree. Kevin should be Tommen's hand. Harry Swift is a toad, and my sister is a fool if she thinks elsewise. The castle gates swung open slowly. "My cars will not have room to accommodate 1,000 men," Jamie told Strongbore. "We'll make camp beneath the western wall. I want the perimeters ditched and staked. There are still bands of outlaws in these parts."
"They need to be mad to attack a force as strong as ours."
Mad or starving, until he had a better notion of these outlaws and their strength, Jamie was not inclined to take any risks with his defences. "Ditched and staked," he said again, before spurring Anna toward the gate. Sir Dermot rode beside him, with the royal stag and lion, and Sir Hugo Vance with the white standard of the King's Guard. Jamie had charged Red Runnet with the task of delivering Willis Manderley to Maidenpool, so he would not need to look on him henceforth. Pierre rode with Jamie's squires on the gelding Peck had found for her.
"It's like some toy castle," Jamie heard her say.
"She's known no home but Harrenhal," he reflected. "Every castle in the realm will seem small to her, except the rock." Jasmine Peckleton was saying the same thing. "You must not judge by Harrenhal. Black Harren built too big." Pierre listened, as solemnly as a girl of five being lessoned by her scepter. "That's all she is, a little girl in a woman's body, scarred and scared. Peck was taken with her, though." Jamie suspected that the boy had never known a woman, and Pierre was still pretty enough, so long as she kept her mouth closed. "There's no harm in him bedding her, I suppose, so long as she's willing." One of the mountain's men had tried to rape the girl at Harrenhal, and had seemed honestly perplexed when Jamie commanded Ilion Payne to take his head off.
"I had her before, 100 times, he kept saying, as they forced him to his knees. 100 times, my lord, we all had her."
When Sir Ilion presented Pierre with his head, she had smiled through her ruined teeth. Derry had changed hands several times during the fighting, and its castle had been burned once, and sacked at least twice. But Lancel had seemingly wasted little time setting things to rights. The castle gates were newly hung, raw oaken planks reinforced with iron studs. A new stable was going up, where an older one had been put to the torch. The steps to the keep had been replaced, and the shutters on many of the windows. Blackened stones showed where the flames had licked, but time and rain would fade those. Within the walls, crossbowmen walked the ramparts, some in crimson cloaks and lion-crested helms, others in the blue and grey of House Frey. As Jamie had trotted across the yard, chickens ran out from under Honor's hooves. Sheep bleated, and peasants stared at him with sullen eyes. Armed peasants, he did not fail to note. Some had scythes, some staves, some hoes sharpened to cruel points. There were axes in evidence as well, and he espied several bearded men with red 7-pointed stars sewn onto ragged, filthy tunics. More bloody sparrows. Where'd they all come from? Of his uncle Kevin he saw no sign, nor of Lancel. Only a maester emerged to greet him, with a grey robe flapping about his skinny legs.
"Lord Commander, Darius honoured by this, unexpected visit. You must forgive our lack of preparations. We have been given to understand that you were bound for River Run.
Derry was on my way, lied Jamie. River Run will keep. And if perchance a siege had ended before he reached the castle, he would be spared the need to take up arms against House Tully. Dismounting, he handed honour to a stable boy. "Will I find my uncle here?" He did not supply a name. Sir Kevin was the only uncle he had left, the last surviving son of Titus Lannister.
No, my lord. Sir Kevin took his leave of us after the wedding.
The maester pulled at the chain collar as if it had grown too tight for him.
I know Lord Lancel would be pleased to see you and all your gallant knights, though it pains me to confess that Darry cannot feed so many.
We have our own provisions. You are?
Maester Ottermore, if it please, my lord, Lady Amorai wished to welcome you herself, but she is seeing to the preparations of a feast in your honour. It is her hope that you and your chief knights and captains will join us at table this evening.
A hot meal would be most welcome. The days have been cold and wet. Jamie glanced about the yard at the bearded faces of the sparrows. Too many, and too many Freys as well.
Where will I find Hearthstone? We had a report of outlaws beyond the Trident. Sir Harwin took 5 knights and 20 archers and went to deal with them.
And Lord Lancel?
Oh, he's in his prayers. His lordship has commanded us never to disturb him when he is praying.
He and Sir Bonifer should get on well.
Very well.
There would be time enough to talk with his cousin later. Show me to my chambers and have a bath brought up.
If it please, my lord, we have put you in the ploughman's keep. I will show you there.
I know the way. Jamie was no stranger to this castle. He and Cersei had been guests here 2 times before, once on their way to Winterfell with Robert, and again on the way back to King's Landing. Though small as castles went, it was larger than an inn, with good hunting along the river. Robert Baratheon had never been loath to impose upon the hospitality of his subjects. The keep was much as he recalled it. The walls are still bare, Jamie observed, as the maester led him down a gallery.
Lord Lancel hopes one day to cover them with hangings, said Ottermore. Scenes of piety and devotion.
Piety and devotion? It was all he could do not to laugh. The walls had been bare on his first visit, too. Tyrion had pointed out the squares of darker stone where tapestries had once hung. Sir Raymond could remove the hangings, but not the marks they'd left. Later, the imp had slipped a handful of stags to one of Darry's serving men for the key to the cellar, where the missing tapestries were hidden. He showed them to Jamie by the light of a candle, grinning. Woven portraits of all the Targaryen kings, from the first Aegon to the second Aerys.
If I tell Robert, mayhaps he'll make me Lord of Dari,
the dwarf said, chuckling. Maester Ottermore led Jaime to the top of the keep.
I trust you will be comfortable here, my lord. There is a privy, when nature calls. Your window looks out upon the Godswood. The bedchamber adjoins her ladyship's, with a servant's cell between.
These were Lord Darry's own apartments.
Yes, my lord.
Oh, my cousin is too kind. I did not intend to put Lancel out of his own bedchamber.
Lord Lancel has been sleeping in the sept.
Oh, sleeping with the mother and the maiden. When he has a warm wife just through the door. Jamie did not know whether to laugh or weep. Maybe he is praying for his cock to harden. In King's Landing it had been rumoured that Lancel's wounds had left him incapable. Still, he ought to have sense enough to try. His cousin's hold on his new lands would not be as secure until he fathered a son on his half-Darry wife. Jamie had begun to rue the impulse that had brought him here. He gave thanks to Ottermore, reminded him about the bath, and had Peck see him out. The Lord's bedchamber had changed since his last visit, and not for the better. Old stale rushes covered the floor, in place of the fine mirrorish carpet that had been there previously, and all the furnishings were new and crudely made. Sir Raymond Darry's bed had been large enough to sleep six, with brown velvet draperies and oakwood posts carved with vines and leaves. Lancel's was a lumpy straw pallet, placed beneath the window where the first light of day would be sure to wake him. The other bed had no doubt been burned or smashed or stolen. But even so, when the tub arrived, little Lou pulled off Jamie's boots and helped remove his golden hand. Peck and Garrett hauled water, and Pierre found him something clean to sup in. The girl glanced at him shyly as she shook his doublet out. Jamie was uncomfortably aware of the curve of hip and breast beneath her rough-spun brown dress. He found himself remembering the things that Pierre had whispered to him at Harrenhal, the night that Kyburn sent her to his bed.
"Sometimes, when I'm with some man," she said, "I close my eyes and pretend it's you on top of me."
He was grateful when the bath was deep enough to conceal his arousal. As he lowered himself into the steaming water, he recalled another bath, the one he'd shared with Brian. He had been feverish and weak from loss of blood, and the heat had made him so dizzy he found himself saying things better left unsaid. This time he had no such excuse.
"Remember your vows? Pierre is more fit for Tyrion's bed than yours."
"Fetch me soap and a stiff brush," he told Peck. "Pierre, you may leave us."
"Aye, my lord. Thank you, my lord."
She covered her mouth when she spoke to hide her broken teeth. "Do you want her?" Jamie asked Peck when she was gone. The squire turned beet red. "If she'll have you, take her. She'll teach you a few things you'll find useful on your wedding night, I don't doubt. And you're not like to get a bastard by her." Pierre had spread her legs for half his father's army and never quickened. Most like the girl was barren. "If you bid her, though, be kind to her."
"Kind? My lord, how? How would I—"
"Sweet words, gentle touches. You don't want to wed her, but as long as you're abed, treat her as you would your bride." The lad nodded.
My lord, where should I take her? There's never a place to
be alone?" Jamie grinned. "We'll be at supper several hours. The straw looks lumpy, but it should serve." Peck's eyes grew wide.
"His lordship's bed?"
"You'll feel a lord yourself when you're done, if Pierre knows her business, and someone ought to make some use of that miserable straw mattress." When he descended for the feast that night, Jamie Lannister wore a doublet of red velvet slashed with cloth of gold and gold chains studded with black diamonds. He had strapped on his golden hand as well, polished to a fine bright sheen. This was no fit place to wear his whites. His duty awaited him at River Run. A darkened need had brought him here. Derry's great hall was great only by courtesy. Trestle tables crowded it from wall to wall, and the ceiling rafters were black with smoke. Jamie had been seated on the dais, to the right of Lancel's empty chair. "Will my cousin be joining us for supper?" he asked as he sat down.
"My lord prefers to fast," said Lancel's wife, the Lady Amariah. "He's sick with grief for the poor High Septon."
She was a long-legged, full-breasted, strapping girl of some 8 and 10 years, a healthy wench to look at, though her pinched, chinless face reminded Jamie of his late and unlamented cousin Cleos, who had always looked somewhat like a weasel.
"Fasting? He's an even bigger fool than I suspected.
His cousin should be busy fathering a little weasel-faced heir on his widow, instead of starving himself to death. He wondered what Sir Kevin might have to say about his son's new fervor. Could that be the reason for his uncle's abrupt departure?" Over bowls of bean and bacon soup, Lady Amariah told Jamie how her first husband had been slain by Sir Gregor Clegane, when the Freys were still fighting for Robb Stark.
I begged him not to go, but my Pete was oh so very brave, and swore he was the man to slay that monster. He wanted to make a great name for himself.
We all do.
When I was a squire, I told myself I'd be the man to slay the Smiling Knight.
The Smiling Knight?
She sounded lost.
Who was that?
The mountain of my boyhood, half as big but twice as mad. An outlaw long dead. No one who need concern your ladyship. Amorai's lip trembled. Tears rolled from her brown eyes.
You must forgive my daughter,
said an older woman. Lady Amorai had brought a score of Freys to Derry with her. A sister, an uncle, a half-uncle, various cousins, and her mother, who had been born a Derry.
She still grieves for her father. Outlaws killed him,
sobbed Lady Amorai.
Father had only gone out to ransom Peter Pimple. He brought them the gold they asked for, but they hung him anyway.
Hanged, Amy? Your father was not a tapestry. Lady Maria turned back to Jamie.
I believe you knew him, sir.
We were squires together once at Crakehall. He would not go so far as to claim they had been friends. When Jamie had arrived, Merritt Frey had been the castle bully, lording it over all the younger boys. Then he tried to bully me. He was very strong. It was the only praise that came to mind. Merritt had been slow and clumsy and stupid, but he was strong.
"You fought against the Kingswood Brotherhood together,"
sniffed Lady Amorai.
"Father used to tell me stories."
"Father used to boast and lie, you mean?"
"We did."
Frey's chief contributions to the fight had consisted of contracting the pox from a camp follower and getting himself captured by the White Fawn. The outlaw queen burned her sigil into his arse before ransoming him back to Sumner Crakehall. Merritt had not been able to sit down for a fortnight, though Jamie doubted that the red-hot iron was half so nasty as the kettles of shit his fellow squires made him eat once he was returned. Boys are the cruelest creatures on the earth. He slipped his golden hand around his wine cup and raised it up. "To Merritt's memory," he said. It was easier to drink to the man than to talk of him. After the toast, Lady Amorai stopped weeping, and the table talk turned to wolves of the four-footed kind. Sir Danwell Frey claimed there were more of them about than even his grandfather could remember.
"They've lost all fear of men. Packs of them attacked our baggage train on our way down from the Twins. Our archers had to feather a dozen before the others fled."
Sir Adam Marbrun confessed that their own column had faced similar troubles on their way up from King's Landing. Jamie concentrated on the fare before him, tearing off chunks of bread with his left hand and fumbling at his wine cup with his right. He watched Adam Marbrunt charm the girl beside him, watched Stephen Swift refight the battle for King's Landing with bread and nuts and carrots. Sir Kenneth pulled a serving girl into his lap, urging her to stroke his horn, while Sir Dermot regaled some squires with tales of knight-errantry in the Rainwood. Farther down the table, Hugo Vance had closed his eyes. "Brooding on the mysteries of life," thought Jamie. "That, or napping between courses." He turned back to Lady Maria. "The outlaws who killed your husband, was it Lord Berwick's band?"
"So we thought, at first."
Though Lady Maria's hair was streaked with grey, she was still a handsome woman.
"The killers scattered when they left Oldstones. Lord Vipron tracked one band to Fairmarket, but lost them there. A Black Order led hounds and hunters into Hagsmire after the others. The peasants denied seeing them, but when questioned sharply, they sang a different song. They spoke of a one-eyed man and another who wore a yellow cloak, and a woman, cloaked and hooded."
"A woman?"
He would have thought that the White Fawn would have taught Merritt to stay clear of outlaw wenches. There was a woman in the Kingswood Brotherhood as well?
I know of her.
How not? Her tone suggested.
When she left her mark upon my husband. The White Fawn was young and fair, they say. This hooded woman is neither. The peasants would have us believe that her face was torn and scarred, and her eyes terrible to look upon.
They claim
she led the outlaws.
Led them? Jamie found that hard to believe. Beric Dondarrion and the Red Priest were not seen. Lady Maria sounded certain.
Dondarrion is dead, said Strongbow. The mountain drove a knife through his eye. We have men with us who saw it.
Oh, that's one deal, said Adam Marbrandt.
Others will tell you that Lord Beric can't be killed.
Sir Harwin says those tales are lies. Lady Amory wound a braid around her finger.
He has promised me Lord Beric's head. He's very gallant.
She was blushing beneath her tears. Jamie thought back on the head he'd given to Pierre. He could almost hear his little brother chuckle.
Whatever became of giving women flowers?
Tyrion might have asked. He would have had a few choice words for Harwin Plum as well, though gallant would not have been one of them. Plum's brothers were big, fleshy fellows, with thick necks and red faces, loud and dusty, quick to laugh, quick to anger, quick to forgive. Harwin was a different sort of Plum, hard-eyed and taciturn, unforgiving, and deadly, with his hammer in his hand. A good man to command a garrison, but not a man to love. Although, Jamie gazed at Lady Amory. The serving men were bringing out the fish course, a river pike baked in a crust of herbs and crushed nuts. Lancel's lady tasted it, approved, and commanded that the first portion be served to Jamie. As they set the fish before him, she leaned across her husband's place to touch his golden hand.
"You could kill Lord Beric," said Jamie. "You slew the smiley knight. Please, my lord, I beg you, stay and help us with Lord Beric and the hound."
Her pale fingers caressed his golden ones.
"Does she think that I can feel that?"
"The sword of the morning slew the smiling knight, my lady. Sir Arthur Dane, a better knight than me." Jamie pulled back his golden fingers and turned once more to Lady Maria. How far did Black Walder track this hooded woman and her men?
His hounds picked up their scent again north of Hag's Mire,
the older woman told him.
He swears that he was no more than half a day behind them. When they vanished into the neck, we'll let them rot there,
declared Sir Kenneth cheerfully. If the gods are good, they'll be swallowed up in quicksand, or gobbled down by lizard lambs.
Or taken in by frog-eaters, said Sir Danwell Frey. I would not put it past the Crannog men to shelter outlaws. Oh, would it were only them, said Lady Maria. Some of the river lords are hand in glove with Lord Beric's men as well. The small folk, too, sniffed her daughter. Sir Harwin says they hide them and feed them, and when he asks where they've gone, they lie. They lie to their own lords.
Have their tongues out, urged Strongbow.
Oh, good luck getting answers, then, said Jamie. If you want their help, you'll need to make them love you. That was how Arthur Dane did it, when we rode against the Kingswood Brotherhood. He paid the small folk for the food we ate, brought their grievances to King Ares, expanded the grazing lands around their villages, even won them the right to fell a certain number of trees each year, and take a few of the king's deer during the autumn. The forest folk had looked to Toyne to defend them, but Sir Arthur did more for them than the Brotherhood could ever hope to do, and won them to our side. After that, the rest was easy.
The Lord Commander speaks wisely, said Lady Maria. We shall never be rid of these outlaws until the small folk come to love Lancel as much as they once loved my father and grandfather.
Jamie glanced at his cousin's empty place.
Lancel will never win their love by praying, though.
Lady Amorai put on a pout.
Sir Jamie, I pray you, do not abandon us. My lord has need of you, and so do I. These are such fearful times. Some nights I can hardly sleep for fear.
My place is with the king, milady.
I'll come,
offered Strongbow.
Once we've done at Riverrun, I'll be itching for another fight. Not that Beric Dondarrion is like to give me one. I recall the man from Tawny's past, a comely lad in a pretty cloak he was. Slight and callow.
That was before he died, said young Sir Arwood Frey. Death changed him. The small folks say, you can kill him, but he won't stay dead. How'd you fight a man like that? And there's the hound as well. He slew 20 men at Saltpans.
Strongbow guffawed.
20 fat innkeepers, maybe. 20 serving men pissing in their breeches. 20 begging brothers armed with bowls. Not 20 knights. Not me.
There is a knight at Saltpans, Sir Arwood insisted. He hid behind his walls whilst Clegane and his mad dogs ravaged through his town. You have not seen the things he did, sir. I have. When he reports reached the twins, I rode down with Harris Haig and his brother Donal and 50 men, archers and men-at-arms. We thought it was Lord Beric's work, and hoped to find his trail. All that remains of Saltpans is the castle, and old Sir Quincy, so frightened he would not open his gates, but shouted down on us from his battlements. The rest is bones and ashes, a whole town. The hound put the buildings to the torch and the people to the sword, and rode off laughing. The women, you would not believe what he did to some of the women. I will not speak of it at table. It made me sick to see.
I cried when I heard, said Lady Amorai. Jamie sipped his wine. What makes you certain it was the hound? What they were describing sounded more like Gregor's work than Sandor's. Sandor had been hard and brutal, yes, but it was his big brother who was a real monster in House Clegane.
He was seen, Sir Arwood said. That helm of his is not easily mistaken, nor forgotten, and there were a few who survived to tell the tale. The girl he raped, some boys who hid, a woman who he found trapped beneath a blackened beam, the fisherfolk who watched the butchery from their boats.
Do not call it butchery,
Lady Maria said softly.
That gives insult to honest butchers everywhere. Saltpans was the work of some fell beast in human skin.
This is a time for beasts, Jamie reflected, for lions and wolves and angry dogs, for ravens and carrion crows.
Evil work!
Strongbow filled his cup again.
Lady Maria, Lady Amorai, your distress has moved me. You have my word. Once River Run has fallen, I shall return to hunt down the hound and kill him for you. Dogs do not frighten me.
This one should. Both men were large and powerful, but Sandor Clegane was much quicker and fought with a savagery that Lyle Crakehaw could not hope to match. Lady Amorai was thrilled, however.
You are a true knight, Sir Lyle, to help a lady in distress.
At least she did not call herself a maiden. Jamie reached for his cup and knocked it over. The linen tablecloth drank the wine. As the red stain spread, his companions all pretended not to notice. High table courtesy, he told himself, but it tasted just like pity. He rose abruptly. My lady, pray excuse me.
Lady Amorai looked stricken.
Would you leave us? There's venison to come, and capon stuffed with leeks and mushrooms.
Very fine, no doubt, but I could not eat another bite. I need to see my cousin.
Bowing, Jamie left them to their food. Men were eating in the yard as well. The sparrows had gathered round a dozen cook-fires to warm their hands against the chill of dusk and watch fat sausages spit and sizzle above the flames. There had to be 100 of them. Useless mouths. Jamie wondered how many sausages his cousin had laid by and how he intended to feed the sparrows once they were gone. They will be eating rats by winter, unless they can get a harvest in. This late in autumn, the chances of another harvest were not good. He found the sept off the castle's inner ward, a windowless, seven-sided, half-timbered building with carved wood doors and a tiled roof. Three sparrows sat upon its steps. When Jamie approached, they rose.
"Where are you going, my lord?" asked one.
He was the smallest of the three, but he had the biggest beard. Inside.
"His lordship is in there, praying."
"His lordship is my cousin."
"Well then, my lord," said a different sparrow,
a huge bald man with a seven-pointed star painted over one eye.
"You won't want to bother your cousin in his prayers."
"Lord Lancel is asking the Father above for guidance," said the third sparrow, the beardless one.
A boy, Jamie had thought, but her voice marked her for a woman, dressed in shapeless rags and a shirt of rusted mail.
"He's praying for the soul of the High Septon and all the others who have died."
"They'll still be dead tomorrow," Jamie told her. "The Father above has more time than I do. Do you know who I am?"
"Some lord,"
said the big man with a starry eye.
"Some cripple,"
said the small one with a big beard.
"The Kingslayer," said the woman. "But we're no kings, just poor fellows, and you can't go in unless his lordship says you can."
She hefted a spiked club, and the small man raised an axe. The doors behind them opened.
"Let my cousin pass in peace, friends," Lancel said softly. "I have been expecting him."
The sparrows moved aside. Lancel looked even thinner than he had at King's Landing. He was barefoot, and dressed in a plain, rough-spun tunic of undyed wool that made him look more like a beggar than a lord. The crown of his head had been shaved smooth, but his beard had grown out a little. To call it peach fuzz would have given insult to the peach. It went queerly with the white hair around his ears.
"Cousin," said Jamie, when they were alone within the sept,
"have you lost your bloody wits? I prefer to say, I found my faith."
"Where is your father?"
"Gone. We quarrelled." Lancel knelt before the altar of his other father.
"Will you pray with me, Jamie?"
"If I pray nicely, will the Father give me a new hand?"
"No.
But the warrior will give you courage, the smith will lend you strength, and the crone will give you wisdom. It's a hand I need." The seven guards loomed above carved altars, the dark wood gleaming in the candlelight. A faint smell of incense hung in the air. "You sleep down here?"
"Each night I make my bed beneath a different altar, and the seven send me visions.
Baelor the Blessed once had visions too,
especially when he was fasting."
"How long has it been since you've eaten?"
"My faith is all the nourishment I need."
"Faith is like porridge, better with milk and honey."
"I dreamed that you would come.
In the dream, you knew what I had done, how I'd sinned. You killed me for it."
"You're more like to kill yourself, with all this fasting.
Didn't Baelor the Blessed fast himself unto a bier?
Our lives are candle flames," says the seven-pointed star.
"Any errant puff of wind can snuff us out.
Death is never far in this world, and seven hells await sinners who do not repent their sins. Pray with me, Jamie."
"If I do, will you eat a bowl of porridge?" When his cousin did not answer, Jamie sighed.
"You should be sleeping with your wife, not with the maid. You need a son with Derry blood if you want to keep this castle."
"Ah, a pile of cold stones. I never asked for it. I never wanted it. I only wanted—" Lancel shuddered.
"Seven saved me, but I wanted to be you."
Jamie had to laugh. "Better me than blessed Baelor. Derry needs a lion, cuz. So does your little Frey.
She gets moist between her legs every time someone mentions Hardstone. If she hasn't bedded him yet, she will soon. If she loves him, I wish them joy of one another. A lion shouldn't have horns. You took the girl to wife. I said some words and gave her a red cloak, but only to please father. Marriage requires consummation. King Balor was made to wed his sister Dana, but they never lived as man and wife, and he put her aside as soon as he was crowned. The realm would have been better served if he'd closed his eyes and fucked her. I know enough history to know that. In any case, you're not like to be taken for Balor the Blessed. No, Lancel allowed. He was a rare spirit, pure and brave and innocent, untouched by all the evils of the world. I am a sinner, with much and more to atone for. Jaime put his hand on his cousin's shoulder. What do you know of sin, cuz? I killed my king. The brave man slays with a sword, the craven with a wineskin. We are both kingslayers, sir. Robert was no true king. Some might even say that a stag is a lion's natural prey. Jaime could feel the bones beneath his cousin's skin, and something else as well. Lancel was wearing a hair shirt underneath his tunic. What else did you do to require so much atonement? Tell me. His cousin bowed his head, tears running down his cheeks. Those tears were all the answer Jaime needed. You kill the king, he said. Then you fuck the queen. I never... Lay with my sweet sister? Say it. Say it. Never spill my seed in her... cunt, suggested Jaime. Womb, Lancel finished. It is not treason unless you finish inside. I gave her comfort after the king died. You were a captive, your father was in the field, and your brother... She was afraid of him, and with good reason. He made me betray her. Did he? Lancel and Sir Osmond, and how many more? Was the part about Moon Boy just a jibe? Did you force her? No, I loved her. I wanted to protect her. You wanted to be me? His phantom fingers itched. The day his sister had come to White Sword Tower to beg him to renounce his vows, she had laughed after he refused her, and boasted of having lied to him 1,000 times. Jaime had taken that for a clumsy attempt to hurt him, as he'd hurt her. It may have been the only true thing that she ever said to me. Do not think ill of the queen, Lancel pleaded. All flesh is weak, Jaime. No harm came of our sin. No bastard. No, bastards are seldom made upon the belly. He wondered what his cousin would say if he were to confess his own sins. The three treasons Cersei had named, Joffrey, Tommen, and Myrcella. I was angry with her grace after the battle, but the High Septon said I must forgive her. You confessed your sins to His High Holiness, did you? He prayed for me. When I was wounded, he was a good man. He's a dead man. They rang the bells for him. He wondered if his cousin had any notion what fruit his words had borne. "Lancel, you're a bloody fool." "You're not wrong," said Lancel. "But my folly is behind me, sir. I have asked the Father above to show me the way, and he has. I am renouncing this lordship and this wife. Hardstone is welcome to the both of them, if he likes. On the morrow I will return to King's Landing and swear my sword to the new High Septon and the Seven. I mean to take vows and join the Warrior's Sons." The boy was not making sense. The Warrior's Sons were proscribed 300 years ago. The new High Septon has revived them. He sent out a call for worthy knights to pledge their lives and swords to the service of the Seven. The poor fellows are to be restored as well. Why would the Iron Throne allow that? One of the early Targaryen kings had fought for years to suppress the two military orders, Jaime recalled, though he did not remember which. Maegor, perhaps,
or the first Jaehaerys? Tyrion would have known. His High Holiness writes that King Tommen has given his consent. I will show you the letter, if you like. Even if it is true, you are a Lion of the Rock, a lord. You have a wife, a castle, lands to defend, people to protect. If the guards are good, you will have sons of your blood to follow you. Why would you throw all that away for some vow? Why did you? Asked Lancel softly. For honour, Jaime might have said. For glory? That would have been a lie, though. Honour and glory had played their parts, but most of it had been for Cersei. A laugh escaped his lips. Is it the High Septon you're running to, or my sweet sister? Pray on that one, Cos. Pray hard. Will you pray with me, Jaime? He glanced about the sept at the guards, the mother, full of mercy, the father, stern in judgment, the warrior, one hand upon his sword, the stranger in the shadows, his half-human face concealed beneath a hooded mantle. I thought that I was the warrior, and Cersei was the maid. But all the time, she was the stranger, hiding her true face from my gaze. "Pray for me, if you like," he told his cousin. "I've forgotten all the words." The sparrows were still fluttering about the steps when Jaime stepped back out into the night. "Thank you," he told them. "I feel ever so much holier now." He went and found Sir Ilyen and a pair of swords. The castle yard was full of eyes and ears. To escape them, they sought out Darry's Godswood. There were no sparrows there, only trees bare and brooding, their black branches scratching at the sky. A mat of dead leaves crunched beneath their feet. "Did you see that window, sir?" Jaime used a sword to point. "That was Raymond Darry's bedchamber, where King Robert slept on our return from Winterfell. Ned Stark's daughter had run off after her wolf, Savage Joff, you recall. My sister wanted the girl to lose a hand, the old penalty for striking one of the blood royal. Robert told her she was cruel and mad. They fought for half the night. Well, Cersei fought, and Robert drank. Past midnight, the queen summoned me inside. The king was passed out, snoring on the mirrorish carpet. I asked my sister if she wanted me to carry him to bed. She told me that I should carry her to bed, and shrugged out of her robe. I took her on Raymond Darry's bed, after stepping over Robert. If his grace had woken, I would have killed him there and then. He would not have been the first king to die upon my sword. But you know that story, don't you? He slashed at a tree branch, shearing it in half. As I was fucking her, Cersei cried, "I want—" I thought that she meant me. But it was the Stark girl that she wanted, maimed or dead. The things I do for love. It was only by chance that Stark's own men found the girl before me. If I had come on her first... The pockmarks on Sir Ilyen's face were black holes in the torchlight, as dark as Jaime's soul. He made that clacking sound. "He's laughing at me," realized Jaime Lannister. "For all I know, you fucked my sister too, you puck-faced bastard," he spat out. "Well, shut your bloody mouth and kill me if you can." Brain. The Septree stood upon an upthrust island half a mile from the shore, where the wide mouth of the Trident widened further still to kiss the Bay of Crabs. Even from the shore, its prosperity was apparent. Its slope was covered with terrace fields, with fish ponds down below, and a windmill above, its wood and sailcloth blades turning slowly in the breeze of the bay. Brian could see sheep grazing on the hillside, and storks wading in the shallow waters around the ferry landing.
"Saltpans is just across the water," said Septon Meribald,
pointing north across the bay. "The brothers will ferry us over on the morning tide, though I fear what we shall find there. Let us enjoy a good hot meal before we face that. The brothers always have a bone to spare for Dog." Dog barked and wagged his tail. The tide was going out now, and swiftly. The water that separated the island from the shore was receding, leaving behind a broad expanse of glistening brown mudflats, dotted by tidal pools that glittered like golden coins in the afternoon sun. Brayne scratched the back of her neck where an insect had bitten her. She had pinned her hair up, and the sun had warmed her skin.
"Why do they call it the Quiet Isle?" asked Podrick.
"Those who dwell here are penitents, who seek to atone for their sins through contemplation, prayer, and silence. Only the elder brother and his proctors are permitted to speak, and the proctors only for one day of every seven."
"The Silent Sisters never speak," said Podrick. "I heard they don't have any tongues."
Septon Merrybold smiled. "Mothers have been cowing their daughters that tale since I was your age. There was no truth to it then, and there is none now. A vow of silence is an act of contrition, a sacrifice by which we prove our devotion to the seven above. For a mute to take a vow of silence would be akin to a legless man giving up the dance." He led his donkey down the slope, beckoning them to follow. "If you would sleep beneath a roof tonight, you must climb off your horses and cross the mud with me. The path of faith, we call it. Only the faithful may cross safely. The wicked are swallowed by the quicksands, or drowned when the tide comes rushing in. None of you are wicked, I hope. Even so, I would be careful where I set my feet. Walk only where I walk, and you shall reach the other side." The path of faith was a crooked one, Brayne could not help but note. Though the island seemed to rise from the northeast of where they left the shore, Septon Merrybold did not make directly for it. Instead, he started due east, toward the deeper water of the bay, which shimmered blue and silver in the distance. The soft brown mud squished up between his toes. As he walked, he paused from time to time to probe ahead with his quarterstaff. Dog stayed near his heels, sniffing at every rock, shell, and clump of seaweed. For once he did not bound ahead or stray. Brayne followed, taking care to keep close to the line of prints left by the dog, the donkey, and the holy man. Then came Podrick, and last of all, Sir Hyle. 100 yards out, Merrybold turned abruptly toward the south, so his back was almost to the septuary. He proceeded in that direction for another 100 yards, leading them between two shallow tidal pools. Dog stuck his nose in one and yelped when a crab pinched it with his claw. A brief but furious struggle ensued before the dog came trotting back, wet and mud-spattered, with the crab between his jaws. "Isn't that where we want to go?" Sir Hyle called out from behind them, pointing at the septuary. "We seem to be walking every way but toward it." "Faith," urged Septon Merrybold, "believe, persist, and follow, and we shall find the peace we seek." The flat shimmered wetly all about them, mottled in 50 hues. The mud was such a dark brown, it appeared almost black. But there were swathes of golden sand as well, upthrust rocks both grey and red, and tangles of black and green seaweed. Storks stalked through the tidal pools and left their footprints all around them, and crabs scuttled across the surface of shallow waters. The air smelled of brine and rot, and the ground sucked at their feet and let them go only reluctantly with a pop and a squelchy sigh. Septon Merrybold turned and turned again and yet again. His footprints filled up with water as soon as he moved on. By the time the ground grew firmer and began to rise beneath the feet, they had walked at least 1.5 miles. 3 men were waiting for them as they clambered up the broken stones that ringed the isle's shoreline. They were clad in the brown and dun robes of brothers, with wide bell sleeves and pointed cowls. 2 had wound lengths of wool about the lower halves of their faces as well, so all that could be seen of them were their eyes. The third brother was the one to speak.
"Septon Meribald," he called. "It has been nigh upon a year. You are welcome. Your companions as well."
Dog wagged his tail, and Meribald shook mud from his feet. "Might we beg your hospitality for a night?"
"Yes, of course. There's to be fish stew this evening. Will you require the ferry in the morning?"
"If it's not too much to ask." Meribald turned to his fellow travellers. "Brother Narbert is a proctor of the order, so he is allowed to speak one day of every seven. Brother, these good folk help me on my way. Sir Hyle Hunt is a gallant from the Reach. The lad is Podrick Payne, late of the Westerlands, and this is Lady Bryeen, known as the Maid of Tarth."
Brother Narbert drew up short.
"A woman?"
Yes, brother."
Bryeen unpinned her hair and shook it out.
"Do you have no women here?"
"Not at present," said Narbert. "Those women who do visit come to us sick or hurt, or heavy with child. The seven have blessed our elder brother with healing hands. He has restored many a man to health that even the maesters could not cure, and many a woman too."
"I am not sick or hurt or heavy with child."
"Lady Bryeen is a warrior maid," confided Septon Meribald, "hunting for the hound."
"Aye?" Narbert seemed taken aback.
To what end?"
Bryeen touched Oathkeeper's hilt.
"His," she said.
The proctor studied her.
"You are brawny for a woman, it is true, but mayhaps I should take you up to elder brother. He will have seen you crossing the mud. Come."
Narbert led them along a pebble path and through a grove of apple trees to a whitewashed stable with a peaked thatch roof.
"You may leave your animals here. Brother Gillam will see that they are fed and watered."
The stable was more than three-quarters empty. At one end were half a dozen mules, being tended by a bandy-legged little brother whom Bryeen took for Gillam. Way down at the far end, well away from the other animals, a huge black stallion trumpeted at the sound of their voices and kicked at the door of his stall. Sir Hyle gave the big horse an admiring look as he was handing his reins to Brother Gillam.
Handsome beast!"
Brother Narbert sighed.
"The seven send us blessings, and the seven send us trials. Handsome he may be, but Driftwood was surely whelped in hell. When we sought to harness him to a plough, he kicked Brother Rawney and broke his shin-bone in two places. We had hoped gelding might improve the beast's ill-temper, but, Brother Gillam, will you show them?"
Brother Gillam lowered his cowl. Underneath he had a mop of blonde hair, a tonsured scalp, and a blood-stained bandage where he should have had an ear.
Podrick gasped. "The horse bit off your ear?"
Gillam nodded and covered his head again.
Forgive me, brother," said Sir Hyle, "but I might take the other ear if you approach me with a pair of shears."
The jest did not sit well with Brother Narbert.
"You are a knight, sir. Driftwood is a beast of burden. The smith gave men horses to help them in their labours."
He turned away.
"If you will, elder brother will no doubt be waiting."
The slope was steeper than it had looked from across the mudflats. To ease it, the brothers had erected a flight of wooden steps that wandered back and forth across the hillside and amongst the buildings. After a long day in the saddle, Bryeen was glad for a chance to stretch her legs. They passed a dozen brothers of the order on their way up, cowled men in dun and brown, who gave them curious looks as they went by, but spoke no word of greeting. One was leading a pair of milk cows toward a low barn roofed in sod. Another worked a butter churn. On the upper slopes they saw three boys driving sheep, and higher still they passed a lich yard, where a brother bigger than Bryeen was struggling to dig a grave. From the way he moved, it was plain to see that he was lame. As he flung a spadeful
of the stony soil over one shoulder, some chance to spatter against their feet. The gravedigger lowered his head. When Dog went to sniff him, he dropped his spade and scratched his ear.